The Trump Whisperer, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. French President Emmanuel Macron is visiting Washington. He's said to have President Trump's ear, and Trump doesn't seem to mind.
Clearly, Trump is very chuffed when he's around Macron. He thinks somehow that they have things in common.
Plus, the Russian grandmothers who've gone looking for family members who joined ISIS.
And they've got a list of 2,000 women and children who've gone missing in Iraq or Syria since the defeat of ISIS last summer.
And the capital of Kyrgyzstan is fighting traffic congestion, but losing its trees.
City Hall is attempting to widen the roads, but to widen the roads, you need to cut down the trees.
Bishkek's Plan B, that and more on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Thanks for being with us today. Let's start here. A French military band playing Daft Punk on Bastille Day last July, as French President Emmanuel Macron and President Donald Trump looked on side by side. The two leaders and their wives also shared a dinner at the Eiffel Tower. So Trump's visit to Paris was a memorable one, and now it's the White House's turn to repay the favor. Today, Macron arrived on a state visit to Washington, and it's fair to say that Macron has worked hard at developing a good relationship with Trump. There are even suggestions that Macron has become a Trump whisperer, able to create a rapport with the president that few others have. Christopher Dickey reports from Paris for the Daily Beast. He says Macron uses a simple and familiar tactic.
Flattery. Macron has spent his brief life, he's only 40 years old, working his way to the top of the French political order by flattering older people and becoming the protege or the friend or even the surrogate son of powerful people. I don't know if he used exactly that technique on Trump, but it's something similar. Clearly, Trump is very chuffed when he's around Macron. He thinks somehow that they have things in common. And for the French, it reminds them a little bit or a lot of the La Fontaine fable of the fox and the crow, where the crow is up on a high branch with a juicy piece of cheese, a delicious-looking piece of cheese in his mouth. And the fox starts to flatter him and says that he's the reincarnation of the phoenix and he's got the most beautiful feathers in the world. And the crow begins to speak and drops the cheese, right. And the fox runs off with it.
Well, so far, if we use Twitter as a gauge, it doesn't really appear that Macron is the focus of Trump anger. Is there agreement among smart people that Macron's approach, whatever he's doing, his approach to Trump is working?
Well, I don't think there is an agreement that it's working. It's working to the extent that they seem to have very cordial relations. And I think that Macron made his move toward Trump at a time when Trump had isolated himself almost entirely from the rest of Europe. Macron stepped forward and said, we need the American president to be with us on Bastille Day in 2017, the 100th anniversary of American involvement in World War I. Your doughboys came and saved us, and you should come and celebrate this with us. And Trump loved the military parade that's always put on Bastille Day, and that's why we're going to have one in the United States. He loved all the pomp and circumstance that was put before him by Macron. And you can even see Macron's influence later at Davos in January when Trump appeared. There was a brass band to receive him on stage. I've never seen anything like that at Davos, but I suspect that Macron told the people who run Davos, Trump will really fall for this. He'll love it. So I think there is that manipulation. But the question is, does this fox Macron run off with the cheese? Does he get something concrete out of all this? And on the issues that he's made very important, where he feels and where he does have very big differences with Trump on climate change, on Syria, on Iran, on aluminum and steel trade, these are not places where Trump has given a lot of ground.
You predicted my next question. What does Macron, if he stepped up to the plate, what does he have to show for it? I mean, do you think he could be the one to tell Trump to stay in the Iran nuclear deal and Trump will obey?
I don't think Trump will obey, but getting out of the Iran nuclear deal is so irrational from a diplomatic point of view and from the point of view of world peace that he might be persuaded at least to stall a little bit longer. The problem is that Trump always will swing back like a compass heading for true north toward his base constituency. And he knows the promises that he made to them that count with them, whether they make sense geopolitically, internationally, or even domestically or not. And he denounced the Iran nuclear deal so many times during the campaign, it's very hard to see him reversing that.
So, Christopher, what does Emmanuel Macron actually have to show right now, kind of as a result for flattering Donald Trump?
Well, the biggest deal, the one that he put the biggest stake in, is climate change. And he would love, dearly love, to bring Trump back into the climate change agreement. But I don't think that's going to happen. And in fact, this is a very risky trip for Macron, it turns out. He's in the middle of a lot of social upheaval in France. I think he'll weather that storm. But if he comes away from Washington after having palled around with Donald Trump and really doesn't have anything to show the French people, it will be hurtful to him politically.
What do you think Macron is hoping to gain from this American audience?
Well, you know, Macron knows that the Americans love him, especially Americans who hate Trump, ironically, because he is everything that Trump isn't. He is elegant, incredibly smart, in command of facts, understands facts very well, can speak extemporaneously at length and in great detail, if necessary, about all kinds of issues.
And he's a generation younger than Trump as well.
Well, and he's a lot younger than Trump. He's, you know, more than 30 years younger than Trump. He's much closer to Ivanka's age than he is to Trump's age, much closer. So I think that he has all these kinds of attributes that make him stand out in contrast. And occasionally, you know, he'll play to the American audience shamelessly. As in, for instance, after the United States withdrew from the climate agreement, he posted a video in English saying, "We'd really like you American scientists to come here and work because we believe climate change is real." So he does things like that, but doesn't seem to damage him too much with Trump because I think the flattery overwhelms everything else.
Well, as you said, Macron is unique for many reasons. Do you think other leaders will be trying to learn from Macron's dealings with Trump, or is he just playing a high-risk game with Trump that other leaders don't really want to get involved in?
Well, I think the problem is that Macron really is a unique commodity. There really are not any other leaders quite like him. I don't think Angela Merkel, in her worst nightmares, could bring herself to flatter Trump the way Macron does. And I think the relations between German Chancellor Merkel and Trump are really rather tense. So it's hard to know how any other leaders could learn from this, except to be encouraged by the idea that people will come around to the value of centrism rather than extremism if you can attach it to someone who seems to be disrupting the system in other ways and who is essentially a new face. Certainly, France has been pulled back from the extremes in a dramatic way by Emmanuel Macron, and one would hope that that could be emulated by others. I just don't think there are a lot more Macrons waiting in the wings anywhere else.
Christopher Dickey reports from Paris for the Daily Beast. Thanks, as always, Christopher.
Sure, Marco.
When Macron and his wife Brigitte leave the state dinner at the White House tomorrow, I can almost guarantee they won't ask for a doggy bag. Sure, that is state dinner protocol, but it's also something you just don't really do in France at any dinner. We Americans have no problem asking for a container to take leftovers home. But in France lately, officials are actually trying to persuade diners to take home what they don't finish, and they want restaurants to cooperate. Adeline Sear has that story.
It's lunchtime at this sunny cafe in Paris. I'm trying to finish a giant croque monsieur, a French ham and grilled cheese sandwich, but it's just too big. Channeling my American side, I go ask the manager if he has a doggy bag for my leftovers.
Doggy bag? No, on n'est pas équipé, c'est ce que vous demandiez.
He says no, he doesn't have any containers. When I point out that it may soon be mandatory for restaurants to provide takeout containers for customers,
pas le temps, comme pour répondre aux questions.
He responds he has no time for that or to answer my questions. When I return to my table, someone has already cleared away my leftover croque monsieur. Hola! In France, even though millennials are getting used to the idea of taking leftovers home, asking for a doggy bag can still be a cultural faux pas. And many travelers here are well aware of this.
I thought it was absolutely verboten. A doggy bag where you bring leftovers home?
Martha Palmer from Racine, Wisconsin, says she comes to France every spring.
And I sneak Ziploc bags in my purse, and I do it under the table because I thought it was so improper. And I didn't want to hurt the chef's feelings or the waiter's feelings. You know, food is serious in France.
So if food is so serious here, so sacred, why is it that we can't honor it by taking it home when there's some left on our plate? What's the big taboo? I asked Chef François Pasteau, who runs the gourmet restaurant L'Épi du Pain in Paris. It's part of a group of restaurants that offer climate-conscious menus. He says bringing food home after a meal is still not part of French culture.
Il y a toujours la barrière psychologique de demander des restes et on se sent un peu gêné.
There's always a psychological block when it comes to requesting leftover takeout, he says. Customers feel embarrassed because they're afraid to look like a cheapskate, like they can't afford to pay for another meal. So they feel guilty about asking for a doggy bag, even though it would prevent food waste and it would be smart to do so. And that's the basic idea behind France's plan to require restaurants to provide takeout containers if customers request them.
Apporte-moi un récipient, un doggy bag que tu as dans ton placard au-dessus. Tu l'as pas tiré avec le couvercle.
François Pasteau shows me the recyclable food container he uses. It's made out of corn pulp.
Une démarche environnementale, y compris au niveau des contenants.
But he says only about 10 customers a year ask him for one. Other chefs I've spoken to say that traditionally, a restaurant meal is something to be experienced on site, under the careful watch of its own chef. There's a view in France that the concept of a dish belongs to the restaurant that created it. So when you take it home to reheat it later, it's as if you were yanking a masterpiece apart and rearranging it haphazardly. But what bothers Jean Terlon is the prospect of a new regulation. Terlon is with UMIH, a large union of the hotels and restaurants industry.
Et on va obliger les restaurateurs, une fois de plus, on va leur ajouter une réglementation supplémentaire pour volontairement acheter des boîtes.
Once again, we're going to force a new regulation on restaurant owners and make them buy boxes, he says. The theory that the doggy bag is an old tradition, especially in the United States, is fine. But they don't fill plates the same way there, and the concept of food is not the same. And portions have a lot to do with why you may not need a doggy bag in France, but you often do in the U.S. I should know, when I ate my first meal in New York City a couple decades ago, I was overwhelmed by the enormous size of my plate of bay scallops, but I felt completely humiliated when my friends asked for a doggy bag from me. I thought it was a joke at first, and then I almost died of shame when a friendly waiter brought my food in a bag. Clearly, I'm over it now. But even if France does go ahead with the proposed regulation, there's still a major issue to address.
The French care so much about their language. They've got to invent a better word than doggy bag.
Martha Palmer from Wisconsin is right about that. The proposed rule suggests gourmet bag or simply boîte à emporter, which just means takeout box. Restaurant union Jean Terlon likes the name Reste avec moi, a play on the word rest, meaning both stay and leftovers.
Je m'imagine la personne qui venait donner moi une reste avec moi.
I'm imagining the customer asking for a box of stay with me, he says.
Il y a un côté Saint-Valentin, ouais.
It's got a Valentine's Day ring to it. So there may be a way to salvage the all-American doggy bag and turn it into something French after all. For the world, Adeline Cyr, Paris.
Coming up later on the show, exploring the city of London's green spaces, some of the oldest anywhere. You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with the world. After a multi-year push by a coalition of forces, ISIS no longer holds much territory in Iraq and Syria. When it did have lots of territory, the Islamic State was attracting thousands of jihadist fighters from around the world. Many of them brought their wives and kids, and some of those relatives, we believe, supported ISIS. Others, though, were brought against their will or were lied to. And now it seems many of these women and children have disappeared. The BBC's Tim Huell was recently in Iraq speaking with Russians searching for their relatives who joined ISIS. My colleague Carol Hill spoke with him.
Tim, how many of these ISIS family members are currently missing?
Well, exactly, we don't know. But the people we've been in communication with all the way through this is an organization of Russian mothers. Obviously, they're mothers mainly from Muslim parts of Russia and other parts of the former Soviet Union. And they've got a list of 2,000 women and children who've gone missing in Iraq or Syria since the defeat of ISIS last summer.
Wow. Working backwards, do we know how many ISIS members came from Russia?
There are many different estimates here, but some people think that more in general fighters, foreign fighters, went from the former Soviet Union than from anywhere else in the world. Roughly speaking, probably maybe 8,000, but these things are very, very inexact, but of which maybe half from Russia.
Hmm. Now, you've been working with a group of grandmothers from Russia whose family members joined ISIS. Did you manage to make contact with any of the ISIS relatives?
Well, it's a very interesting story. Everything moved very slowly. I've actually been to Iraq twice since last summer, every time taking me with me scores and scores of photographs from these Russian grandmothers, of their daughters, of their grandchildren, asking everybody I could possibly ask, have you seen this girl? Have you seen this woman? Really trying to get into jails, trying to get into camps. It's extraordinarily difficult, particularly trying to get access to Iraqi jails. But then after months and months at the end of last year, in the fall of last year, when no one had heard anything at all, some extraordinary whispered secret messages came through to relatives in Russia. The very first one that came through was to a woman in Moscow from her sister, and basically really just whispering a voice message on a mobile phone.
There are about 200 of us here, all Russian speakers. Why are they holding us prisoner? I can't stand it anymore. It's so cold here. They don't even give us proper blankets.
But then even more extraordinary, she said, we're prisoners, it turned out, in a secret dungeon of this militia group. We don't know why we're being held, 200 of us, in two squalid rooms, one toilet, one bathroom for all of us. And the only time, this was in December, the only time in 4 months we've been allowed out into the fresh air is when we were paraded outside for a group of men from Iran, and they believed that they were going to be sold into prostitution in Iran. Anyway, we then gathered from further messages, we discovered the name of the commander who was holding them. He belongs to a force called the Popular Mobilization Units. That's a kind of militia force attached to the Iraqi army. And I went to Iraq I confronted him. First of all, I was kind of rather gentle with him because I knew he was still holding the women. I didn't want to endanger them anymore. And then I heard that they'd actually gone from his custody, and I was able really then to confront him seriously. And this is how the encounter went. I know you said they were in very good conditions, five-star conditions.
Yes, you can't see them.
But that's not right, is it? Because we've seen messages from them. It was cold, it was wet, you know, they had one toilet, one bathroom for 200 people.
No.
But we've
this is not truth.
But we've seen messages from them. They got messages to their relatives in Russia. We've seen those messages.
How you can't...
But it's terrible. I mean, they describe, you know, how the guards were beating them.
This is wrong.
Also, in those messages, they say that you were running that place, that you were keeping them captives.
No.
Also, I have to say, in those messages, they say, we are afraid that you are going to sell us to Iran.
No, this is a wrong idea.
So what happens now? I mean, what's going to happen to these people? Is there a process?
Well, very slowly, we know they're beginning to be put on trial, and one or two of them, already those trials are over. So just in the last couple of days, the first two of those Russian ISIS wives have now been given life sentences for terrorism. So you can imagine now that all the grandmothers, the relatives back in Russia are in absolute panic.
Some people might find it difficult to sympathize with families connected to ISIS, especially those who traveled with their relatives who were serving with ISIS. Was that something you struggled with in doing this story?
Well, absolutely. I was very torn about it. I've been torn about it all the way through. And it's quite obviously on one level. I've got to know over the months the grandmothers back in Russia really quite well. I've visited them. I've been talking to them, messaging them back and forth for months and months. And obviously their pain at having lost or no longer knowing where their daughters and their grandchildren are obviously is very, very intense. But what's strange, of course, is that they lost contact only since the defeat of ISIS. And for the 3 years, basically, that ISIS was in charge of huge tracts of Iraq and Syria, of the Iraqi city of Mosul, of the Syrian city of Raqqa, those grandmothers were in almost daily contact with their daughters and their grandchildren. And what did they talk about? You know, they talked as though the families were leading completely normal lives in the Islamic State. You know, they talked about, you know, babies getting their first teeth, learning to walk, learning to talk, all those kind of things. Well, what we know is that out there on the streets, beheadings were going on, rapes, executions, you name it. You know, and you think, didn't you wonder about that? Didn't you wonder that was the kind of environment that your daughter was living in? Well, you know, the answer to that, of course, I asked those questions over and over again. And the answer is, what could my daughter have done? What could she have done? You know, if there was even a hint on the phone, because all these kind of messages were monitored, you know, on text messages, whatever. If there was any hint, you know, that of course, you know, they say my daughter, whoever, whichever it was, wanted to come back, realised they'd made a terrible mistake, wanted to come back from Islamic State. If there'd even been a hint of that, they could have been executed.
The BBC's Tim Ewell speaking there with my colleague Carol Hills. I'm Marco Werman. Nicaragua's government used lethal force to put down protests over changes to Social Security. Now those protests are turning into something bigger.
What feels really different is how many different kinds of people have joined it.
How the protests in Nicaragua started and where they're headed. That's up next here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. It's The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Let's go back to Nicaragua in the 1980s. Marxist leader Daniel Ortega was considered a real man of the people. It is a very different Ortega these days. He's the president, and some Nicaraguans are mad at him. Protests have been going on since last week, then a police crackdown leaving some 24 people dead. And yesterday, President Ortega announced that he will not follow through with the policy change that started the protests in the first place. That all has to do with Social Security reforms. Frances Robles is a reporter with the New York Times, and she's in Managua following events on the ground there. First of all, Frances, tell us what Ortega was planning to do to Social Security in Nicaragua, this plan that he's since backed off of.
The government had proposed some changes to the Social Security system. They're in really financial straits. And so essentially, they were having people contribute more and retirees were going to receive less. And it served as a detonator. I mean, it just really set people off.
So now that the plan is off the table, are the protests continuing?
The protests are continuing. So the protests start Wednesday, ostensibly about the Social Security issue. And then the police crack down on the protests. The pro-government forces attack the protesters, the students. And so then, really by Thursday even, it really almost had nothing to do with Social Security.
Yeah, so the protesters aren't done. So give us a sense of the scene with those protests. You had pensioners and students protesting. Who else?
regular people. That was one thing that was really remarkable. So who's kind of leading the banner here? Definitely the students. And then you're seeing just regular residents in the community coming out of their houses with boxes of water, with face masks, with anything to help the students.
You called these protests remarkable, Francis. I mean, there have been protests against the Ortega government before. How are these different?
What feels really different is how many different kinds of people have joined it. You know, so yesterday, as I was driving around Managua, all the supermarkets and major stores had been looted. They were empty. And then the few stores that were not ransacked were being protected by members of the community. And the people in the community were saying, you know, we're here so that the students don't get blamed for looting that they didn't commit. And then you have the major business community. So you have COSEP, which is basically representative of the richest people in Nicaragua. Even they started coming out and supporting the students. You have the Catholic Church coming out and supporting the students. And so Daniel Ortega has control over every institution of the government. But what you see now is that he lost control of the streets.
I mean, the history shows that Ortega is a survivor. He was president in the 80s against strong opposition from the U.S., voted out in 1990, but then came back in 2007. Now, 11 years later, how authoritarian has it become? And does the police crackdown on the protests and yesterday's concession by Ortega suggest his hold on power is weak?
I think it shows that he's scared. I don't know that you would say that he's losing control per se, but there's no question that this is the biggest test of his presidency, of his current presidency.
It sounds like what you're saying, though, Francis, is that if these protests started off about Social Security reforms, it's not that anymore. What is this really about?
It's really the rule of law, justice. You know, in the past, there used to be term limits in Nicaragua. And so Daniel Ortega did a variety of maneuvers to get the constitution changed. And so now there are no term limits. So it's those kinds of things that he has done, the changing electoral law here, changing the constitution there, that people consider illegitimate. And they want a sweeping address of all of that. I think if there was a single demand, I would say a recall referendum. I mean, I don't know that it would ever happen, but I think that that's what they want.
I began by talking about the 1980s when Daniel Ortega first came up. I'm just curious, what does the word Sandinista even mean anymore in Nicaragua? Do people use it?
Oh, sure. I mean, there are people who are members and devout supporters of this party. For many, many years, right-wing neoliberal presidents had control of this country, and they stole money. They spent lavishly on themselves. And so Daniel Ortega, in his leftist, socialist, Sandinista presidency, he maybe did all those things. You know, I'm sure he doesn't live as a pauper, but he remembered to give to these poor people. So if you're a low-income person in Nicaragua, and the one guy who gave you a tin roof and a property to your house was Daniel Ortega, who are you going to vote for? And now you're seeing more people sort of switching to the other side, because I think even some of the Sandinistas are against what's happening now.
Francis Robles with the New York Times speaking with us from Managua, Nicaragua. Thank you very much. This is great.
Thanks for having me.
We hear that the U.S. State Department is pulling embassy staff out of Nicaragua as those anti-government protests continue. Things are also heating up in Mexico, but not like they are in Nicaragua. In Mexico, it's the upcoming presidential election that's getting people amped up. All five candidates slugged it out last night in a high-energy debate. Carla Zabludovsky is Mexico Bureau Chief for BuzzFeed News, and she had her eye on one candidate in particular last night.
The frontrunner is Andrés Manuel López Obrador. He is a leftist populist. This is his third try at the presidency, and he is winning by 48%, according to newspaper Reforma earlier this week. And we'll just have to see how much that changed after the debate, but it's likely that it didn't change much.
Yeah, what did it look like with López Obrador in the middle of these five candidates? Were they ganging up on him?
Oh, they were definitely ganging up on him. It turned into an Andrés Manuel roast. But he didn't take the bait. He knew that in order to win, to not lose, he just had to keep his cool. His task last night was to not get angry, and he did pretty well.
What are the main issues there that the candidates are talking about?
Oh, corruption was front and center. If security was the issue in the last administration, corruption was it for this one. But security also came up. AMLO said something fairly controversial a few weeks ago. He
AMLO,
said that
that's
he would...
the local acronym for Andrés Manuel López Obrador, correct?
Yes, yes, Marco. Thank you. He said that he would propose an amnesty for drug kingpins. And so that was part of it, ganging up on him. The other candidates kind of dug into that proposal, saying that it's not the way to go to forgive and forget, although his proposal was not about forgetting, but it is about forgiving.
So when you say security is a big issue, we're talking about security against the drug cartels, basically. Is that right?
Yes. Last year was a record year in Mexico for homicides. So it's also a pretty significant issue. And what's interesting is that one of the candidates, Margarita Zavala, she's the wife of the president who launched the war against drug cartels in 2006. So she was also roasted a little bit for her husband's policies.
Now, on the subject of corruption, there's one independent candidate, Jaime Rodriguez, known as El Bronco, and he's come up with some fairly controversial proposal to fix corruption. Tell us about that.
Yes, he said that he would propose chopping off thieves' hands. It was a very shocking but not surprising proposal. He's always talked tough, but it was shocking enough for the reporters, for the journalists asking questions and moderating the debate to ask a couple of times if he really did say that and if he meant it.
How did Donald Trump figure into the debate?
Well, there were two key moments during the debate where he came up yesterday. The first one was when Andrés Manuel talked about selling off the presidential plane, which has been very controversial for its very, very high price tag. He said that he wanted to sell it to Trump because Trump is a show-off and it's a very fancy airplane. And the other moment was when Margarita Zavala, the wife of the president who launched the war on drugs, she said that she will defend Mexicans from criminals and Trump.
How much do ordinary Mexicans care about this election, Carla? Do a lot of Mexicans think that who they vote for could actually change their lives?
I think everyone is aware that this is a very significant election. Anaya, one of the candidates yesterday, he put it very clearly. This is not just an election to choose a party or a candidate. This is an election to define and decide what kind of nation Mexico wants.
Carla Zabludowski, Mexico Bureau Chief for BuzzFeed News. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Marco.
We hear about poachers and how they're one of the main threats to wild animals in many parts of Africa. But if you take Uganda, the efforts to protect wildlife there also faces another challenge, pressure from local communities and residents who worry about how their livelihoods are in competition with those wild animals. My BBC colleague Patience Atuhaire reports from a nature reserve in western Uganda known for its lions.
The wildlife of Queen Elizabeth National Park are increasingly becoming enemy number one for the communities here. It is 7 a.m. and 35-year-old Francis Kaiwa is taking his herd out of Hamukungu village to graze. When he sends them out each morning, he is not sure how many of them will return home at dusk.
About a year ago, my cows were coming back home from grazing in the hills when one of them was attacked by a lion. There is someone appointed by the Wildlife Authority who coordinates the community with the park officials. I approached him but received no help. I went several times to the park headquarters and got nowhere, so I eventually gave up.
As we speak, a herd of elephants is ambling past about 100 meters from where we are standing. We are in their grazing territory. About 2 weeks ago, a pride of 11 lions, 3 mothers and 8 cubs, were found dead by rangers not far from here. They are suspected of having died from eating poisoned meat. That is 11 out of less than 100 lions left in this park, killed at once, allegedly by members of this community. I'm walking through a small farm of maize. I understand about 2 days ago, a herd of elephants went through here, and you can see where they trampled onto the plants and crushed them into the ground with their feet. You can see small gullies all over the garden where they left their footmarks. And this area is about 4 kilometers from the boundaries of the conservation area, but animals, wild animals, still come all the way here and terrorize the farmers' livelihoods. Because of the elephants, Vincent Migade is never sure what the yield will be like every season.
At this stage, because the maize is still young, they just trample all over it and destroy it. But if the elephants come when it has already put on cobs, they eat the cobs. Sometimes they come like 20 times in 1 month. They keep returning every night. When it happens, I report it to the park officials. Once they came here and took photos and collected evidence of what had happened, but they never returned.
How much do you lose in regard to your yield and what you plant?
This maize, for instance, I paid workers to clear the land and plant it. So if it's all destroyed, that's a loss for me. I also have to hire someone to watch over the garden overnight, to chase away the elephants. I pay him a salary. If we have no harvest, we both lose.
We've just come across dozens of goats, mostly mothers and their kids, grazing within the park area. They don't seem to have a minder. They are just wandering around. The rangers here tell us that this has become common practice where people just let their livestock into the park area and the livestock sometimes gets eaten up by the wild animals. The Uganda Wildlife Authority, the country's conservation body, says that it is illegal for anyone to keep livestock, grow crops, or live within the park. But they are doing all they can to strike the delicate balance between conservation and people's livelihoods. Edward Asalu is the chief warden for the Queen Elizabeth Conservation Area.
We do patrols in all these areas where lions are. We also do sensitization of the communities, to engage with the communities, to tell them the values of wildlife. And then we have the revenue sharing program, where we give 20% of the gate collections to the neighboring communities to make them feel that, you know, there's something that they benefit from their park.
It remains an uphill battle, though, between the human residents and the wildlife. Edward Asalo, chief warden of the Queen Elizabeth Conservation Area in Uganda, ending that report from the BBC's Patience Atuhare. This Friday is Arbor Day, but I would argue you gotta respect trees every day of the year, so we're happily getting ahead of ourselves today. In a moment, we'll tour the green spaces in the city of London, that is. First, though, we're off to Bishkek, the capital of Kyrgyzstan in Central Asia. Bishkek was once famous as a green, leafy city, but in recent years that's changed as Bishkek has grown more and more congested. Here's how Almaz Choreyev of the BBC's Kyrgyz service describes those changes.
You know, I watched some of the videos taken in the 1990s, and the city I see there and the city I see now is like the moon and the earth. So there you see this green city with not a lot of cars, but very, very green city. It's just loads of trees. Wherever you walk, you see trees. Now we have modern buildings. It looks nice. But in terms of greenery, we're moving more and more towards just standard industrial sort of city where you don't have this character anymore. What's very, should I say, scary is when you go out, just 45 minutes drive outside of the city, there's mountains and forests. When you climb up a mountain and you look inside the city, you actually see a thick smog.
Not surprisingly, Chureyev tells us, cars are a big source of that pollution in Bishkek.
So this is sort of a catch-22 situation because a number of cars in the city is growing, which means traffic is becoming unbearable. So City Hall is attempting to widen the roads, but to widen the roads, you need to cut down the trees. So in 2017, the City Hall cut down 2,938 trees. But at the same time, they planted 10,200 trees after the roads are widened. However, the problem here is not the number of trees that are being planted. Although they're planting thousands and thousands of trees, majority of them are not looked after. The old trees can actually reach underground and reach the water which is underground, whereas new ones, if you don't look after them, when there's hot temperature, they end up just drying up and dying.
But Bishkek residents are being told that there is a plan B, planting a whole new forest just outside the capital.
The mayor's office actually has the plans to forest an area just on the outskirts of Bishkek, about 15-20 minutes drive. There's many issues with it. This is an area where trees don't grow, so you have to bring the water underground back up.
Yeah, that's a tough one. Plus, many Bishkek residents have been fleeing the city's congestion and building weekend homes right where the government wants to put the forest. The BBC's Almaz Chureyev says there's no word yet on how the government plans to convince them to leave. Well, it actually feels finally like spring here in Boston, so all these bare trees here will soon look normal again. Perfect backdrop for walking in the city, this city, or the city, the single square mile at the heart of Greater London, their financial district. It's London's historic heart. It's also very crowded. And so it's kind of incongruous that this was one of the earliest cities in the world to set aside urban green spaces for public use. Here's our Livable Planet reporter, Carolyn Beeler.
Every day, nearly 500,000 workers stream into the white stone banks and office buildings in the city, as it's called here. But it's not all business in Europe's financial capital. Hidden behind courtyard walls and through narrow passageways are roughly 200 tiny islands of green. On a breezy early spring afternoon, the guy in charge of them is giving me a tour.
I'm Colin Buttery. I'm Director of Open Spaces in the City of London.
Buttery's pretty new to the job, but he's taking care of some very old spaces. Some are relics of the city's twisted medieval grid. Others were established during Victorian times. As the city was growing more crowded and smog-choked, civic leaders set aside outdoor space for workers.
In about 1878, an act of Parliament basically gave the public right of access to open spaces within the city.
At the time, those spaces were mostly churchyards. The city opened them up so workers could eat lunch there or stroll through on the way home from the office.
I think the Victorians, they recognised the health and well-being benefits of open space. Sitting quietly, reading a newspaper or reading a book in a nice environment.
Buttery and I are talking in the park in front of St. Paul's Cathedral. Office workers in tailored suits stroll by, and a student sits on a bench sketching the 300-year-old cupola.
I like to think of all the people who have sat in the churchyard eating their sandwiches, the numerous generations enjoying exactly the same view that we're enjoying today.
The next large batch of open spaces emerged from the ashes of World War II. There's an example just north of St. Paul's.
This little space is called Christ Church Greyfriars, and as you can see, is basically a garden in the footprint of a church that was bomb damaged. So only the tower is left.
Inside that tower and some partial walls, there are trellises with climbing vines that stand where the church columns used to be. A visitor sits on a bench placed for quiet reflection.
It is quite formally laid out, partly because it is still consecrated ground.
Back out on the street, we head up a set of stairs to an echoey elevated walkway that lifts pedestrians above the traffic below. Some kids in school uniforms walk by in a noisy pack. Just like the old church that's now a park, this walkway and many of the buildings it connects were built after this part of the city was flattened in the German Blitz.
I think the planners straight after the war were very imaginative in trying to make the best of what had been left after the World War II bomb damage.
Buttery points out another example, a huge pool with fountains that's at the center of a 60s-era apartment complex.
This helps to be a bit like a air conditioning system for the city.
Today, Buttery manages these spaces with 21st century environmental concerns in mind. Back at street level, he shows me several new planters with shrubs and evergreens that are good at filtering out polluted city air. He's also planting species that will thrive as the climate changes.
I want to ensure that I can pass on to future generations something that's in as good or better condition, not let small things like climate change get in our way.
He's kidding about climate change being a small thing. But he says actually lots of native species here will fare pretty well as the weather gets hotter and weirder. In this ancient city, it turns out even some of the plants are good at adapting. For The World, Carolyn Beeler, The City of London.
And that'll do it for us today. Time to take a walk outside. We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman, back with you all tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.